What is up, you guys? Welcome to another edition of Controversial Thoughts. I want to talk about connections between diet and mental illness today. This is a fascinating concept. So often, mental illness, whether it's depression, anxiety, bipolar, schizophrenia, psychotic disorders, are thought of as purely derangements of neurotransmitters. But there is a large body of evidence, a very large body of evidence, suggesting that these disorders are much more than neurotransmitter derangements, and that the neurotransmitter derangements in these illnesses are often secondary to an underlying inflammation, an underlying inappropriate activation of the immune system in the brain, cerebrospinal fluid, the spinal cord. These are all contiguous and bathed in cerebrospinal fluid. So if the neurotransmitter derangements are not the original piece of this puzzle, and we're just treating something down the line, like we always do in medicine, we treat the symptoms without actually treating the root cause, what might be the root cause of these mental illnesses? And so in this video, I want to talk about the large amount of evidence, the preponderance of evidence suggesting that the root cause is inflammation. And I would suggest autoimmunity in some sense, that the immune system is incorrectly responding or reacting in the brain and spinal cord, leading to these disorders, leading to derangements in neurotransmitters, leading to other problems, and that treating neurotransmitters is the worst way to address these illnesses. That if your psychiatrist, if your physician is giving you medications, or you know someone who's being treated and their physician is only working with neurotransmitters and not thinking about neuroinflammation and microglial cells and changes in microglial cell phenotypes, that they are essentially 30 years in the past. They are operating on 30-year-old information and not thinking about what we know today. And to be fair, mainstream Western medicine ignores many of these concepts, which are blatantly in the spotlight. They're very clearly demonstrated in the research. And so from that, I think we will make the leap to, can diet alter these things? And what is the cause of neuroinflammation? My hypothesis in this video and in the work that I do is that so many of these autoimmune diseases, so much of this inflammation, this inappropriate activation of the immune system is based on evolutionarily inconsistent diet. So we'll go over all of that in this video. And at the end, I will do a bonus segment, which will not be on Instagram, which will not be on YouTube, which will only be on Rumble, or if you're listening to this on a podcast, where I will talk about recent developments with COVID. But obviously, that will get censored everywhere except those platforms. So let's dive into the mental health and inflammation stuff. So this is super fascinating. Studies like this, a meta-analysis of cytokines and major depression, clearly point to the fact that there are significantly higher concentrations of the pro-inflammatory cytokines, TNF-alpha and interleukin-6 in depressed subjects compared with control subjects. While both positive and negative results have been reported in individual studies, this meta-analytic result strengthens the evidence that depression is accompanied by activation of the immune system, of the IRS. So pretty striking findings in that study. These compounds, TNF-alpha, IL-6, these are cytokines, or if you're British, cytokines, that are involved in communication between immune cells. These are text messages between immune cells telling each other, there's a pathogen, be on high alert, except there's no pathogen in depression or bipolar or anxiety or schizophrenia. It's an autoimmunity. It's an inappropriate activation of the immune response. And this rabbit hole goes even deeper. We can see clear evidence that in people who have attempted suicide, that there are also similar trends in elevated levels of IL-6, the same cytokine. So the IL-6, interleukin-6 in the CSF, the cerebral spinal fluid, was significantly higher in suicide attempters than in healthy control subjects. Patients who performed violent suicide attempts displayed the highest IL-6. This is brain on fire. There was a significant positive correlation between the MADRS score, which is an index of depression, and CSF, cerebrospinal fluid, interleukin-6 levels in all patients. IL-6 and TNF-alpha correlated significantly with 5-HIAA, which is a breakdown product of serotonin, and HVA, homovanillic acid, which is a breakdown product of dopamine, in the CSF. So they propose a role for cerebrospinal fluid, IL-6, in the symptomatology of suicidal behavior, possibly through mechanisms involving alterations in dopamine and serotonin metabolism. So as they say in that study, alterations in neurotransmitters are secondary to inflammation in the central nervous system, in the cerebrospinal fluid, in the brain. There's also good evidence that in people who are depressed, who are anxious, bipolar, schizophrenic, we see activation of microglial cells. These are brain-derived macrophages. We also see this in neurodegenerative disorders like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, interestingly. They switch between two phenotypes called the M1 and the M2 phenotype. And when these macrophages in the brain, known as microglial cells, get turned on, you have a brain autoimmune response essentially happening. So let's just move on from this point. Point one, brain on fire. Inflammation in the central nervous system, this is the root cause of mental illness, but it's not being treated this way. We're treating the second effect, which is neurotransmitter abnormalities. And of course, as all of you know, if you know someone in your life who's being treated for a mental health issue, those secondary drugs have lots of bad side effects. I'm not saying that they're not useful at times, but what I am saying is that they have bad side effects and we should not be using them without regard for those side effects, especially when we are ignoring the root cause of these illnesses. Okay, let's keep moving on to some more points and go deeper down this rabbit hole. What else do we know about brains of individuals who have mental health illnesses like depression? We know that their brains are quote unquote insulin resistant, meaning that insulin action in the brain doesn't work like it should in these individuals. That's not that surprising, right? How fascinating is this? So we've gone from inflammation to insulin resistance. We know these go hand in hand. Insulin resistance as a shared pathogenic mechanism between depression and type 2 diabetes. This is well documented in the literature, but how many psychiatrists, how many physicians understand this? Yet another study that I can show you will corroborate the exact same thing. We can look at this one as well and see the same type of pattern. Insulin resistance in the brain alters dopamine turnover and causes behavioral disorders. This is a study in a rodent model, but it illustrates the things I was talking about first, that inflammation, which is obviously going to go hand in hand with insulin resistance, and we'll get to how those mechanisms are connected in a moment, will affect the way that neurotransmitters are produced and used in the brain, and that can lead to these problems. Why are we treating neurotransmitter focused? Why are we treating with a neurotransmitter focus without looking or asking these questions? What is causing brain insulin resistance and what is causing brain inflammation? These are the questions we should be asking before we throw medications at people. This is what grinds my gears, you guys. This is why I do the work I do. One more study that I want to share that's a particularly interesting study. Brain insulin resistance, a treatment target for cognitive impairment. That would be dementia, like Alzheimer's, which we know has been termed type 3 diabetes, and anhedonia, which is a loss of interest in activities. In medical school, we're taught to ask people about anhedonia, and I think that this is the best indicator of whether someone has brain inflammation. If you know people in your life who don't find pleasure in anything anymore, that is anhedonia. That is a tragic place to be, and that is connected with brain insulin resistance. And what they found in this paper and other studies is that without the actions of insulin, insulin is a critically important neuropeptide needed for cognitive functioning, as well as other neurotrophic, neuromodulatory, and neuroprotective processes. While other studies suggest brain insulin resistance may manifest independently as part of underlying brain pathology, in mental illness, this is clearly demonstrated. So what they're saying here is that current treatment for depression is symptom suppressing as opposed to disease modifying. This is the problem with mainstream Western medicine. And this is not the result of well-meaning, intelligent physicians. This is a lack of prescience in the way we are thinking about the paradigm. And this underscores the need for novel treatment interventions. I would say this underscores the need for a fucking focus, sorry for my French, on actual root causes of insulin resistance in the brain. And let's think, is it possible that insulin resistance in the brain might be caused by the same things that cause insulin resistance in your muscles or your body? That would be too easy. Of course it is. That makes a ton of sense. But why are we not connecting these? Why are we not asking these questions, guys? As many of you know, if you've listened to my stuff in the past, I think there is a close, an intimate connection between inflammation, autoimmunity, disorders of the immune system, and insulin resistance. And my suggestion, my hypothesis is that insulin resistance develops first and that inflammation, autoimmunity follows. That disorders of the immune system having to do with inappropriate immune responses follow from insulin resistance, which is better known as metabolic dysfunction. So at its root, I believe so many of the chronic conditions that we suffer from, whether they're autoimmune or otherwise, and I think many can be grouped in this autoimmune genre, are insulin resistance, aka metabolic dysfunction. So then we must ask the question, if we keep asking why, right? Why are neurotransmitters disordered? Well, because of insulin resistance and inflammation. Why is the insulin resistance and inflammation happening? Then we start to think about leaky gut and leaky brain, because we know that these are all connected. So let's go further down the rabbit hole and ask, what is causing insulin resistance and the corresponding inflammation, immune activation in the brain? There are many cues to this. Let's start with this paper. This is a great title, Bread and Other Edible Agents of Mental Disease. This is an amazing paper that deserves to be read in its entirety, but I will say that I'll read some of the abstract. And they say, we present the implications for the physiological sciences of the findings that in all of us, bread, number one, makes the gut more permeable and can thus encourage the migration of food particles to sites where they are not expected, prompting the immune system to attack both these particles and the brain-relevant substances that resemble them. And number two, releases opioid-like compounds, exorphins, which we'll talk about in a moment, capable of causing mental derangement if they make it to the brain. So this paper is full of gems. Grains are the seeds of grasses. You guys have heard me talk about this before. Grains are seeds. Grasses may or may not have evolved to let their seeds be eaten, but certainly they do not want them to be digested into pieces that will then be incapable of passing on the plant's genes. This is exactly the type of things that I have talked about in the past, guys. Look at this point. Plants have engineered a wide variety of poisons. Over 50,000 defensive compounds have been identified so far. This is exactly the type of things that I'm talking about. This is just coming straight out of my mouth. Interestingly, compounds in wheat, like gluten, have interactions with things in the brain that are capable, at least in rodents, and I'm quoting from the paper in here now, of crossing both the gut and the blood-brain barriers and interfering, among other things, with the action of nerve growth factor. How crazy is that? The gluten or other exorphins could cross the blood-brain barrier, end up in the brain, and cause problems. A postmortem study of 82 schizophrenic patients found rates of stomach, small intestine, and large intestinal inflammation in an impressive, respectively, 50, 88, and 92%. They're looking at three studies there. That's interesting. Any abnormal presence of microbes triggers the release of the protein zonulin. You guys have heard about this. When the gut gets triggered, it releases zonulin, which widens the gap junctions between cells so that water can move into the intestine and flush out bacteria via loose bowel movements. But that allows the passage of large molecules in immune cells. And that is where inflammation may start. And this is, again, where it's all connected. So now we're looking at connections between diseases like arthritis, asthma, type 1 diabetes, multiple sclerosis, and leaky gut. Fenestrations in the gut mucosa. If you heard my podcast with Evan Brand this week, you know that we were connecting leaky gut and worse COVID outcomes. I don't know if I can say that on Instagram. We'll see if they censor that. But even common spices and food components modulate gut intestinal permeability. Gluten stimulates zonulin release. We know this. In all of us, I'm quoting from the paper, zonulin increases the permeability, not only of the intestinal wall, but also of other no less interesting barriers, notably the blood-brain barrier. So what this paper is saying, in no uncertain terms, the hypothesis they're advancing very clearly is that gluten and other exorphins, which are actually lectins, are causing the gut to become leaky. And that can also cause the blood-brain barrier to become leaky. Is this the beginning of inflammation? Is this the beginning of this pathology? It's possible. There are some incredible studies that have been done looking at this, but they're some in the 1960s and 1970s, so everybody's forgotten about them, but they've actually looked at groups in psychiatric wards with less gluten-free diets, which is just the beginning of the lectin rabbit hole, as you know, and gluten-containing diets, and the gluten-free diets do better. Why do we not repeat these studies now? It's crazy. I just want to make this point. During digestion, gluten is broken down into hundreds of thousands of fragments that are not further dissolved. Some of them resemble morphine and have been named exorphins. So they're actually like endorphins, but they're exorphins. And these proteins are released from other, exorphins are released from other proteins as well, notably casein in milk. I've talked about this. This is gluteomorphin and casomorphine, and albumin in rice and zein in corn. This is why I'm not a huge fan of rice and corn or any grains, guys. You can get these exorphins, which can bind to endorphin receptors in your body and potentially have negative effects. So let's think about this. Let's go back to the first principles approach. plant seeds don't want to get eaten. These are, in a way, defense molecules that can cause havoc in our guts, havoc in our brain barriers. Lectins are a huge cause of this. This is not pseudoscience. This is played out so many times. But in psychiatry, in mental health work, we're never telling people, go on a low lectin diet, go on a grain-free diet, go on a animal-based diet and see if this improves your mental health issues. That would be amazing. So the other thing I think we need to be worrying about here is what causes insulin resistance. So we know that lectins, we know that things like bread and wheat and grains and seeds, which have these lectins, can cause permeability to the gut, and that can lead to all sorts of issues. But what causes insulin resistance? What causes metabolic dysfunction? If you've listened to my stuff, you know the answer to that question. In my opinion, my hypothesis is that this is mainly inappropriately large amounts of linoleic acid in the human diet. Did a recent podcast with Tucker Goodrich that break our cells by creating excess of highly oxidizable fats in the membranes, cardiolipin and mitochondria, and by affecting the way that fat cells work. Broken fat cells are the beginning of metabolic dysfunction, and the breakdown products of linoleic acid, specifically HNE, 4-HNE, 4-hydroxynonenal, a molecule you'll be familiar with if you listen to my podcast with Tucker Goodrich, is known to affect fat cells negatively. So let's just go one more step down this rabbit hole. I know we're very deep in it, and then I'll bring us back full circle and look at how damaging insulin resistance can be, and how insulin resistance is probably at the root of so many of these issues. And yes, what I'm saying here is that if you're depressed, if you're anxious, psychotic, schizophrenic, bipolar, know if you have insulin resistance, get a fasting insulin, check these things, understand what's causing insulin resistance and metabolic dysfunction. This, I believe, is at the root of so many of these issues and is so often overlooked. And that is a tragedy of current Western medicine. I just want to make one point before I go further. If you had any questions about the implications of these illnesses, I want to show a couple of slides. The number one cause of disability in the world is depression. The number two cause of death among young people is suicide. These are not rare. This is the greatest health burden that we suffer as a people today. Depression, suicide, this is the greatest loss of productivity that we suffer. The number one. 264 million people with anxiety disorders, 50 million people with dementia. These are hugely problematic, guys. And I believe their treatment is being done incorrectly. We're not thinking about it properly. So I want to show you a couple of technical papers. Bear with me. This is where we really get to the meat of the matter here. Look at this one. 4-HNE in connection with adipocyte biology, implications for obesity and metabolic syndrome. If you missed it earlier, 4-HNE is a breakdown product of linoleic acid, and it breaks fat cells. Our studies demonstrate that acute and repeated exposure of adipocytes, fat cells, with physiologic low concentrations of HNE is sufficient to promote oxidative stress. Impaired adipogenesis, that is at the center of metabolic dysfunction. When your adipocytes cannot divide, they become overly swollen and they release free fatty acids. That is called adipocyte hypertrophy versus adipocyte hyperplasia. They alter the expression of adipokines and increase lipolytic gene expression to increase free fatty acid release. That is metabolic function right there. And it is connected with a breakdown product of linoleic acid known as 4-hydroxynonenal. So we got a little technical there. If you need to go back and look at that in more detail, look at the podcast I recently did with Tucker Goodrich. This will blow your mind, guys. Okay. I want to tell you about one more thing, and then we'll wrap this one up. This is a very fascinating condition known as familial lipodystrophy, partial lipodystrophy, Dunnegan type of lipodystrophy, and it's a fascinating condition that is a monogenic form of insulin resistance. One gene mutation causes insulin resistance in these individuals. They have early coronary artery disease. They have dyslipidemia with high triglycerides, low HDL. Their LDL is not changed though, right? And they develop all sorts of problems with their fat cells, and their free fatty acids are higher. Meaning when you have lipodystrophy, you can't put fat in your subcutaneous. So all of your fat goes into your visceral fat. Those fat cells become overburdened and they release free fatty acids. And that is what causes metabolic dysfunction. So this is a single genetic mutation, a monogenic problem causing massive insulin resistance. It is a real clue and a corroboration of the fact that insulin resistance is connected with broken fat cells. So these LMNA mutations that underlie familial partial lipodystrophy, this Dunnegan monogenic lipodystrophy, have insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, early coronary heart disease, abnormalities of the nuclear envelope, which is where the LMNA protein lives, recapitulates a phenotype, the most important attributes of the common insulin resistance. If you look at the lipids here, these Dunnigan patients have LDLs, which are 107 milligrams per deciliter. I converted for you here from millimoles per liter. Their familial controls, an average of 150. It's not an elevated LDL that's causing coronary heart disease in these people because elevated LDL isn't what causes coronary heart disease. It's insulin resistance. It's metabolic dysfunction related to defects in the fat cells from this one gene, this LMNA gene. That is where the problem lies. So let's take this all home. What am I saying in this video? I am saying that mental health is metabolic health. Mental health is metabolic health. If you are mentally unwell, you are likely metabolically unwell, and you have inflammation in your brain and your spinal cord. How do you treat it? You get rid of the foods that are causing leaky gut, leaky brain, blood-brain barrier, and you get rid of seed oils, which are causing metabolic dysfunction and insulin resistance. That is how we should be treating depression first and foremost before we turn to medications. An animal-based diet, I believe, is a super powerful intervention for mental illness. I will say that loud and clear. An animal-based diet is an incredibly powerful intervention for mental health illness. If you don't know how to do an animal-based diet, email us at radicalhealth@heartandsoil.co. We've heard this from so many people. I want to read you guys a testimonial of someone whose mood improved with our desiccated organ supplements from Heart and Soil and an animal-based diet. Check this out. This is the kind of stuff that makes me motivated to do the work I do. This is a review with our Lifeblood supplement from Wayne D. My energy level has been amazing since I started taking Lifeblood, which is our suet, our high stearic acid suet, Lifeblood and Firestarter. So Firestarter is a suet. Lifeblood is one of our other supplements at Heart and Soil. I sleep very soundly in the evening, wake up with more energy than I've ever had. When I look at my body composition, it's awesome. My six pack is back. I haven't done one sit-up. I do lightweight training 3 times a week, but nothing too crazy. Not only is my energy level high, but my mood is so positive. I've been in and out of depression for the past 20 years, but I've never been in such a good space in my life. My family and close friends notice a confidence that I've never had before. I really wish this information was available to me 20 years ago, but if someone were to guess my age now, I guarantee they would be 20 years off. This is why I do the work that I do, guys, because moving things at the foundational level, correcting insulin resistance, correcting metabolic dysfunction, getting the foods out of your diet that are causing leaky gut, that are causing this blood-brain barrier, fenestrations, the grains, the legumes, the lectins, this is all part of an animal-based diet, which is meat and organs, either fresh or desiccated, like we make it hard in soil, the finest grass-fed, grass-finished, regeneratively raised, desiccated organ supplements on the market, and doing that with the least toxic plant foods, which are much less likely, which are not going to cause gut permeability, the fruit and the honey. That's why we do what we do, guys. This is a possible way to change the course of Western medicine. This is the hypothesis that I advance. Depression is inflammation. Depression is metabolic dysfunction. Changing your diet, cutting out seed oils and high lectin-containing foods, things that cause leaky gut, there are many other things that can do that too. That is how we should treat mental illness. I'm recording this as the sun is setting, so my lighting is losing a little bit, but I wanted to give you guys all the promised rundown on COVID stuff. Again, this is not going to be anywhere that it can be censored. There was a really, really crazy post from USA Today today or earlier this week that got me really fired up. And this is the type of quote unquote misinformation that you're seeing on mainstream media. This is Candace Ayers, fully vaccinated for COVID-19, infected by others who chose not to be vaccinated. That cost her life, her obituary reads. And if you read the comments, of course, we're saying this is a super tragedy, but this is clearly fake news. The vaccine does not prevent transmission of this virus, guys. And this we have demonstrated multiple times. There are so many studies now coming out, which are so striking that I don't know how the mainstream media is going to keep ignoring this. Studies like I talked about with Evan Brand, COVID-19 mandates are now pointless. Look at this study. Vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals have similar viral loads in communities with a high prevalence of SARS-CoV-2, the Delta variant. They're shedding the exact same. Go back to the podcast I did with Evan Brand. I do not think there is good evidence to corroborate the claim that vaccination prevents the spread of COVID. And if that is the case, man, everything is built on a house of cards now. COVID-19 vaccine mandates are now pointless. COVID-19 vaccines do not keep people from catching the prevailing Delta variant and passing it to others. This is an interesting paper by Nina Pierpoint that has been talked about many times. She's an MD, PhD. You guys can read this. It's online as well. basically, the take home here is that the mainstream media wants to paint the picture that it's the unvaccinated that are killing people. But if the vaccinated and the unvaccinated can both spread COVID, and they appear to do so at the exact same rate, the copy threshold, which is an indication of the nasal carriage of SARS-CoV-2 in someone that's vaccinated versus unvaccinated, is exactly the same. You can spread COVID and you can get COVID in the exact same way if you're vaccinated or unvaccinated. This is media, just blatant propaganda. And we do know there is a signal for vaccine efficacy in terms of emergency hospitalizations, severity, and deaths, but there's no signal that vaccine changes the number of cases at all. Could this be why we're seeing such a huge spike in Israel and other countries that have over 80 to 90% of their population that is vaccinated? I think so. The best meme I saw today was a Willy Wonka meme saying, I can't wait until the fifth round of this disease when the people who have had four shots are blaming the people who have only had three shots for killing everyone. This is going to be an endless booster, just charade, guys. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't get the vaccine. You should weigh your risks and benefits. My mom and my dad got the vaccine. But if you believe the vaccine is going to prevent you from catching COVID or spreading it to someone else, you should take another look at the data. I don't think it supports that. And certainly don't believe the media narrative that the quote unvaccinated are the ones to blame here. I think it's up to you to be metabolically healthy. And that is where the buck stops. So stay radical, you guys.